You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
We're back. So what are we smoking this week, Brad?
Man, you almost didn't let me finish that one. We are smoking the Rocky Patel Special Reserve Sun Grown Maduro.
Yeah, this is a brand new cigar that just came out from Rocky Patel. And we were lucky enough to, you know, be at the official release party last week when it was released here in Georgia. And I gotta say this, I've always been a fan of Rocky Patel's. Like I said, the Super Lajero has been like pretty much my go-to cigar lately. And this is another one I think is definitely going to make the list of regular smokes if and when I can find it again, because they completely sold out at the release party.
Yeah, I mean, this cigar, just to put it in perspective, I smoked one, and I immediately, about, I don't know, I'd say halfway in, went and bought a box for myself.
Yeah, luckily we did that, or we would not have had cigars to review on the podcast, because they did not make it through the party. I don't know how many boxes they brought, but they sold out completely.
Yeah, so this features a sun-ripened Connecticut broadleaf wrapper and an aged all Nicaraguan blend and a binder and filler tobaccos. And, you know, this is coming out of the factory in Esteli. You know it's going to be good. I got to say, man, this thing has some strength. It's got complexity. I mean, it has everything and some that I enjoy in a cigar.
Yeah, it's not overpowering. It's definitely like a medium to full-bodied, but it has a lot of flavor. You definitely get like notes of coffee and, you know, chocolate and some, you know, spice and caramel. And it just has like a, I don't know, just like an interesting taste to it even before you light it. Just like the tobacco itself has got like a lot of flavor. And yeah, this is definitely going to make it on my list of go-to cigars.
I mean, while we were at Dragon Con, I lit up one of these cigars, and, you know, this probably, you know, maybe it was just a group around, but, I mean, I had 7-8 people walk up to me asking me what I was smoking because the fragrance and everything of the cigar. They're just like, man, that smells amazing. Yeah. You know, and these people weren't smoking cigars themselves, so, yeah. You know, I don't know if they were cigar smokers or not. I wish I had a few to hand out to folks, but, you know, the more I kept for myself, the more I can smoke later.
Exactly. And, you know, another thing, speaking of Rocky Patel, this is also our 1-year anniversary of podcasting. So this is kind of a special episode. And since this is a special episode, we have a surprise later on in the podcast that we've not really talked about publicly. But we did get to sit down with Mr. Rocky Patel at the cigar event and interview him for the podcast, so you'll be hearing that later on. Like I said, we've kind of kept it secret. You know, we've told a few people in person, but it's not been up on our Facebook or anything yet, so surprise!
Yep, and, you know, I gotta say, you know, not only are we talking, you know, cigars in general, but we're also going into, you know, the history, the legislative aspects of cigars that, you know, it's important. So, you know, be sure to listen, be sure to lend your support. You know, we want to make sure that cigar smoking is available. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that don't understand cigar culture in general that are looking to try to put a stop to these things. Yeah. And a lot of it has to do with cigarette companies because this is their direct competition.
Yeah, and I got to say, like I said, that's, I'd met Rocky before, but this is like the first time we really sat down and spoke to him at length about anything, and hell of a nice guy. Super appreciate him, you know, making his time available to us and, you know, and speaking with us. And like I said, I can't say enough about good things about him or his, you know, cigars. So, you know, check out the interview later on in the show. But since this is our anniversary podcast, woohoo! And, you know, what's your thoughts of now that we've been doing this for a year? What's some lessons you have learned from, like, you know, this time last year?
I've learned not to do the Beer 30 segment prior to any other segments. I have learned that, you know,
We violate that rule often.
Yeah, you know, two nerdy guys sitting down in a basement, you know, can attract hundreds of thousands of listeners and followers. And, you know, that aspect of things has just been absolutely phenomenal. I mean, when we started this thing, you know, we did it just as a gig, like, hey, we're having these conversations anyway. Let's just start recording and, you know, organize our thoughts a little bit, see if folks listen. And, you know, people have. And, you know, that to me, you know, allows me to flourish in my creativity, you know, and it's just awesome to know that, you know, it didn't take millions of dollars or anything of that nature. You know, it's awakened a passion that, you know, I really didn't know about in the podcasting world prior to this endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, we've met so many cool people, not just people that listen to the show, but also other podcasters and stuff on the network. And like I said, it's a great community that we have.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable to me how supportive the community is, you know, and it doesn't matter, you know, fandom, geekdom or whatever. I mean, there's somebody out there, you know, that's willing to support it, willing to voice their ideas, their opinions and thoughts. And, you know, just having this open creative expression is just absolutely phenomenal to me. And that's what, you know, drives me to, you know, continue doing the podcast. So it's been an awesome roller coaster.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, when we first started doing this, I was like, first couple episodes, I'm like, yeah, I don't know if we're going to be still sitting here smoking a year from now, but we haven't run out of ideas yet. And we keep getting motivated to come up with new stuff each week. Is there anything that, you know, in the next year you'd like to maybe try different that we've not attempted before?
I don't know. I think after a year of doing this, I think it's time, you know, maybe we start looking into trying to do some live stuff, you know, bring our audience into the mix, give folks an opportunity to, you know, give feedback and everything real time and see what happens with it.
Yeah, I'd like to do some, like, you know, video stuff eventually. That's something I would like to change up and bring to the podcast, or even not just video stuff, but, you know, maybe I like maybe start doing more cigar reviews, you know, not on the podcast, you know, do some more like written reviews on the website or something like that. Just, you know,
kind of create the Cigar Nerds blog, if you
yeah,
will.
Yeah, you know, make more content available to the people, you know, for people that are like, y'all don't talk enough about cigars. Like, well, like, you know, here, go read what my, you know, 3-page dissertation on what I thought of this cigar.
No, that would absolutely be awesome.
Like all things, it's, you know, time, and whether or not we have any of it.
I mean, that's one thing that the podcast had taught me is, you know, there is a lot of time and a lot of effort involved behind the scenes that, you know, folks don't oftentimes realize, but it never feels like a chore or feels like work. I mean, there's a passion here, yeah. And, you know, that passion is what motivates us to continue doing this.
Eventually get around to doing that second podcast we keep talking about that we never get around to recording. We've got till October. The new shows start in October. We have to finish before then.
All right, so it's on the calendar now. So it's an official thing. It's going to happen.
And like, I just want to, you know, take this time to thank the people that have listened to us and have emailed us and have gone on to iTunes and given us reviews and liked our Facebook pages and whatnot. Because, you know, if it wasn't for, you know, you people letting us know that, hey, you're freaking listening to this crap, you know, it would just be two guys talking to themselves in a basement. But the fact that, you know, people continue to download the show and, you know, see us out at events and tell us how much they, you know, enjoy what we're doing, you know, makes us want to keep going with it. And like I said, I appreciate that that wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome to be around, you know, like-minded folks, you know. I mean, we've sat down many times and, you know, just had people walk up and like, oh yeah, you guys are from the Cigar Nerd podcast. And, you know, that's just an awesome feeling, you know. In a way, kind of my music career never kicked off. So, you know, I guess this is the next closest thing to my rock stardom.
Yeah, and they're not mistaking us for the Stogie Geeks either. They actually know who we are.
When?
All right. And with that, I guess we'll get into the main topic. We lost a legend since the last time we recorded. You know, Mr. Wes Craven, if you're a horror nerd like we are, you definitely know who that is. So this is our Tribute to Wes Craven episode.
Stay tuned, folks.
Hey,
And welcome back to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. It's time to get a little spooky up in here and pay tribute to the godfather of horror, Mr. Wes Craven.
Yep, August 2nd, 1939 to August 38th, 2015. You know, director, writer, producer, his horror films, his slasher films, dude, those are going to have a place in history from now and until the end of time, I think. I mean,
yeah, he's definitely the reason why most of us have trouble sleeping at night, because and Wes Craven's impact on the horror genre was so, like, I can't tell you who directed Friday the 13th or, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre or any of that other stuff, but
Toby Hooper.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Like, so this is one of those that you don't know off the top of your head unless you, like, look it up. But when you start talking about stuff like Scream and Freddy and all that stuff, you know, Wes Craven's is synonymous with the movies that he has been involved in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got The Hills Have Eyes, The Last House on the Left, People Under the Stairs. I mean, just so many, you know, different varieties of films. I mean, you know, although they're mainly horror films, I mean, they take completely different spectrums a lot of times. And that's one of the things that, you know, his films have really stood out for and allowed him to create a name. There's a lot of movies that I don't think would have been produced, without Wes Craven's influences and the reaction that he gained from fans. Those are things, I mean, you know, just one of the most memorable. You go to any Halloween store in October, you see the Scream mask. You automatically know what movie it's from. You go to a garden supply shop, you see, you know, a pair of garden shears or something like that. You automatically attribute that to Freddy Krueger. I mean, you know, those are the things your nightmares are made of.
Yeah, and like I said, he's been around forever. Like, one of his first movies was 1972's Last House on the Left, which was his first movie that was written, edited, and directed by Wes Craven. And like I said, it was, there's been a more recent remake, but the original 70s version is just, like, all out disturbing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I went through Netflix watching a lot of the Wes Craven films, and some I hadn't even heard of, really before. And, you know, it's very interesting to see the influences and impact that, you know, other films, you know, yeah, they might have been reboots or, you know, remakes, but they don't have that essential essence that Wes Craven brought to the table. Excuse me.
Yeah, they're, I was just reading about some of the details of Last House on the Left, too, and, you know, these girls who wander out and end up getting captured by this gang of escaped serial killers, child molesters, and psychopaths, which, if you know a little bit about Freddy Krueger, that's pretty much his biography as well.
Yep, very much so.
And so you kind of see those influences on some of his later works, but I would say one of the things that made his stuff great is when you start talking about Jason and some of these other slasher movies, there's always an actual killer that these people are running from, something that they can fight against, or, you know, if you were in that situation, there's, you know, something that you can fight against. But with Craven's movies, the situations he always puts people in are like attack you at your weakest moments. Like, for example, Freddy. I mean, he comes at you in your nightmares. I mean, you know, when you are sleeping is your most vulnerable time. And, you know, he really played on that. I mean, you know, in his early life, he had a degree in, like, you know, psychology and philosophy and stuff like that. And you definitely see that in his directing stuff. Cause like I said, you know, using Freddy as an example, how do you defend against something that comes at you when you're sleeping? I mean, that is your absolutely most vulnerable time.
You stay awake forever.
The thing is, staying awake will kill you. I mean, it's like there's no way to defend against Freddy because not sleeping will eventually drive you insane, and like you can go without food longer than you can go without sleep. You eventually will can you know oh, yeah, die yeah. from lack of sleep.
I mean, your body's just going to shut down anyway. I've come
close to it a few times.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, Wes Craven was really good about putting people at their most perilous. You know, and it really makes you question. You know, how do you survive? How do you fight, you know, a formidable foe like that? I mean, there's nothing you can do in that aspect.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, it's an intangible object that will just freaking kill you as soon as you doze off.
Yeah, I was watching a documentary that Wes Craven did that I thought was really interesting. It's like Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue, but it's talking about, you know, how they did a lot of the special effects for Freddy and stuff like that, and like, you know, the scenes where, you know, they're getting dragged up a wall or something like that. Like, they had entire, you know, props that, you know, people were literally spinning that room upside down and stuff like that.
Yeah, it was on a big Kimball.
Yeah, I mean, those practical effects like that, I mean, are a lot of times what sold the movie. And a lot of times, you know, too, is... You know, they didn't necessarily tell the actors, hey, this is what's going to happen. You know, things would just, blood would splatter a certain way and somebody would react to, you know, them getting a liquid on them that they weren't anticipating, and just the natural reaction would get captured on camera. And that's what made those movies so realistic in a lot of aspects, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the first movie came out in 1984. Like I said, we're just going to jump right into, you know, Freddy Krueger and all those things. Yeah, the original Nightmare on Elm Street came out 1984, was like made for $1.8 million, made $25 million. But it's one of those things that's it's just so legendary that it, you know, just invades pop culture even all these years later. And you don't realize until you start looking at it, Wes Craven only did that, like, the first movie. He was the co-writer on the third movie, and then he did the Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which was the last real Freddy Krueger movie, because I don't count the reboot. But yet, when you think of Freddy Krueger, you just automatically assume that he was involved in all of those films, because he was such, you know, made such an impact with that first film that you don't even realize that, yeah, he's not involved in the others.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I think really put New Line Cinema, you know, as an independent film company on the map. You know, in fact, they go on to say that, you know, that's, you know, one of the reasons they were so successful is because of the Nightmare franchise.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, casting Robert Englund too as Freddy. That was another thing. Most of your typical slasher movies, just a mindless, silent killer, you know, chopping people up. But with Freddy, that was the first almost horror comedy.
Yeah,
because he brought personality to the killer.
Yeah, I mean, that's
killer.
The thing. You don't see that with Jason. You don't see that with Michael Myers. You didn't see that with Leatherface. I mean, you know, Freddy's there to crack the jokes, to be the wise guy, and to, you know, hit you, you know, not only emotionally and physically, but, you know, he's there to play that mental game, where I don't think a lot of the other big-name serial are, you know, work of horror arts, you know, those people couldn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at his story, too, Freddy Krueger was a child molester that was burned alive by the, you know, people of his town, and that's how he became, like, this, you know, nightmare curse on the people of this town. But through Robert Englund's portrayal and through Wes Craven's writing, you kind of like the guy. I mean, you end up cheering for the bad guy in half these movies, because he's just so damn funny and... Well, charismatic, you know, even though he's ripping your guts out, and
I mean,
you know,
that was one of the things that was talked about in the documentary was, you know, is vigilante justice the right thing? I mean, you know, is it right for a group of people, regardless of how heinous the crime, to, you know, be judge, jury, and executioner in that scenario?
Because it didn't work out very well in this scenario.
No, and I mean, that's I oftentimes wonder if that's what allowed Freddy to live on for so long, you know, is, you know, the nightmares that maybe the people originally had about, you know, this atrocity they committed against this individual, you know, if those aren't haunting at them, that allowed, you know, Freddy to actually come to fruition.
Yeah.
I don't know. Could we do a prequel of Freddy based on that analysis? I don't know.
I mean, the reboot and everything else, I'm like... It wouldn't surprise me if they tried to do a Freddy origin story.
I mean, that was one of the things that I didn't like about the reboot is, you know, Freddy's origins...
Yeah, he just wasn't likable in the new movie.
Well, they were always hinted at in the original films, you know. But, you know, the new film, I mean, it put it right there out on the table. And, you know, to me, it lost a lot of that, you know, the stuff that made Freddy so charismatic and so memorable.
Yeah, they just made him like a dirtbag in the new one. That's why I've not set the whole thing. It's freaking horrible. But yeah, I mean, what Wes Craven did like an excellent job of developing that character and making him a bad guy that you know, as much as you hate what he's doing, you kind of like you enjoy the ride he brings you on. I mean, it's just he's
even
like,
if it's a school bus ride through the middle of the desert through hell.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, he's. He's like what would happen if a stand-up comedian became a psychopath?
Well, I think there's a fine line in that anyway. I mean,
yeah.
You're good comedians. They have to know how to hate.
Yeah, Freddy had an open mic night. That's oh, and like I said, that and also this movie launched the career of Johnny Depp. This was his first, film
role.
Debut.
Yeah.
So, yeah, without this, you know, we wouldn't have, 1,500 Pirates of the Caribbean movies or whatever we're up to now.
Charlie and the Chocolate, was it Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
Yeah, and he did the remake of it.
Yeah.
Edward Scissorhands, of course. And even, he's got a new movie coming out called Black Mass that doesn't even
I want to stop you on the Edward Scissorhand thing. So, you know, what is the irony of going from a Freddy Krueger, to an Edward Scissorhand. Like, do you see the relation of the two characters there? Like,
Edward Scissorhands could almost be the G-rated version of Freddy Krueger. Oh.
I just thought that was an interesting comparison. Let's just keep with the sheer glove thing.
But his new movie doesn't even look like him. He's, all bald and, old and stuff. And he's, some, mafia guy in the 60s or 70s or some shit. It's wild. But, yeah, this... Yeah, there's a lot of movies where the sequel isn't as good as the original, and then with this one, the third movie, which was co-written, he didn't direct it, but he co-wrote the third movie, which was Dream Warriors. And that's almost, probably my favorite movie of the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Yeah, I mean, Dreamweavers had a lot of memorable moments. Or Dream Warriors, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Dreamweaver.
I don't know where I was going with that. This is the reason we talked about not doing Beer 30 before we do the main segment.
I blame the DayQuil. Yeah, but yeah, that whole thing where there's kids in a mental institute, basically because Freddy's driven everybody crazy, and he's picking off these kids in a mental institute that you have to, learn to... basically fight back.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you had, people trying to commit suicide to, stop the dreams and everything else. And, the hospital is basically oh, you people are just, insane. That's why you're here. This thing of Freddy Krueger doesn't exist. And I don't know. This one was creepy, I think, just from the, puppet maker aspect of things.
Where he using the one guy as a marionette, just hanging him up by his, tendons and, blood veins and stuff, and working him like a freaking puppet is just, that's a horrifying image.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, that strikes me. The school bus scene strikes me. The scene where Johnny Depp is laying in the bed and, all of a sudden it just becomes a big pool of blood. I mean, that's another one.
I remember that scene, the first one. Yeah, where he finally dozes off and the hand just comes up out of the bed and drags him into a hole in the bed and just starts shooting a freaking geyser of blood.
And I mean, that also, one of the things, the bathtub scene, where you see Freddy's hand just come up between the girl's leg and the tub. I mean, stuff like that. I mean, it just really plays on your psyche, something furious.
Yeah, and this one, too, has Nancy, the survivor of the original one, is now working at that hospital, and she's pretty much the only one that believes the kids that, Freddy's real and they're not just batshit crazy.
Yeah, I mean, that one was intense, I mean, the other thing, too, sitting there watching TV and, Freddy just pop out of the TV screen and stuff
That's one of my favorite Freddy quotes, too, is this where like he like the TV comes alive and like grabs her and like shoves her face into the TV and it's like, welcome to prime time, bitch.
Yes.
That's one of the greatest Freddy Krueger lines of any of the movies.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I don't know. I mean, there's so many memorable quotes that, you know, Freddy spouts out over the course of the franchise and everything. And those are the things that, you know, like you said, he's the one character that really has personality. I don't think there's a, you know, even fast forwarding to Rob Zombie's, you know, House of a Thousand Corpses and stuff like that. Like, people didn't have the, you know, character and the intellect that Freddy, you know, brought to the table. So, I mean, there's a whole different level of charisma that just doesn't exist these days, I don't think. And I don't think anybody will ever recreate what, you know, Wes Craven and Robert Englund were able to do.
Yeah, and in this one, too, they finally, you know, find out about what really happened to Freddy and try to find his bones and bury him in holy ground, like... I don't know, you've seen in a lot of the episodes of Supernatural when they've got a ghost screwing with people is you got to burn the bones and salt and burn the bones. That's pretty much, you know, how they finally try to end Freddy, which of course never works, but it works enough for this movie until the, you know, the sequel comes about.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, even Freddy going to hell, you know, with Jason Voorhees didn't work out too well.
Yeah, made for, this one came out in 1987, made for $4.5 million, made $44.7 million.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing, man. Critics were harsh on Freddy, you know? I mean, that's one reason why I don't really give, you know, critic reviews much more than a bat of the eye, you know, because oftentimes I don't think they're seeing things from this perspective that an actual horror movie buff would or anything of that nature. But then again, that's what they're paid to do, is to critique and criticize and talk shit about.
Yeah, the I mean, it spawned, what, six? Well,
I think there was a total of 9 movies in the entire Freddy franchise.
Yeah, there was 5 movies, then Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, then Wes Craven's New Nightmare, Freddy vs. Jason, and then the freaking reboot. But yeah, if you don't count the reboot, there's like 8 movies total.
But I think that it's also spun off some novels and some other things too, right?
I mean, it's even had a video game, which was weird.
What system was that? I don't remember the video game.
I just vaguely remember it, but...
I remember there being a, like, Jason Voorhees Friday the 13th game on original Nintendo. Yeah, that's right. I'm going all the way back to the 1980s, but, you know, you're just basically wandering around Camp Crystal Lake trying to avoid Jason at all costs, but I'd like to get my hands on a Freddy game, or, you know, see somebody do an updated version of a Freddy game.
Yeah, the, And Wes Craven's, like, you know, last involvement with Freddy was the Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which was a weird movie. I mean, it was, like, seriously meta movie. It came out in 94. But in this one, Freddy's fictional. It's the... Basically, he's haunting and attacking the people making the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. And it, you know, stars the original actress... Heather Langenkamp, who is supposed to be playing, you know, Nancy again, yet again, and all of a sudden Freddy starts popping up and killing the cast and crew and family of the people making this new Freddy Krueger movie.
Now, let me ask you, you were talking, you know, we were having an off-the-air discussion a couple of days ago about a Netflix movie you had watched, The Houses That October Built, or something of that nature. Do you think... maybe this film is where they got some of those ideas to make, you know,
the blurring the line between fictional and non-fictional. Maybe. I mean, this was kind of an interesting, you know, way to do it, is that, you know, basically the story of it is, and Wes Craven is even in this movie playing himself as the writer of the Nightmare on Elm Street series. And at one point, Heather goes to talk to him because, you know, Freddy's been haunting her. I think, I don't know if at that point in the movie, he is like, at some point he kills her husband and is like after her child and, you know, goes and talks to Wes about what's going on. And literally he shows her the script and the conversation they're having is like in the script. He's like, you know, basically Freddy was something from his nightmares, which in reality, that's kind of how he came up with the character. But he's like, the only way to keep him at bay is to tell these stories. Telling these stories keeps his memory alive and keeps him trapped in the dream world. Uh-huh. You know, as soon as we stop paying attention to him and people start forgetting about him, that's when he escapes and starts, you know, like, so basically telling the story of Freddy has kept him trapped all these years.
Yeah, and talking about, you know, the story of Freddy, I mean, one thing about this film is, you know, I think this film, you know, depicts Freddy a lot more, you know, closer to what Wes Craven originally envisioned for, you know, Freddy, being more menacing, less comical. You know, he even got some updated attire and his appearance changed in this film.
Yeah, because like, you know, most of the Freddy movies start where you show some him building the glove or whatever. And this one started with somebody building this, like, glove, but then it shows it's like the special effects guy on the movie building the glove, but it eventually comes to life and becomes part of Freddy. And it's this weird biomechanical glove nearly where it's almost made out of like flesh and bone and stuff. It's like probably the weirdest version of the Freddy glove that's been in any movie. And it's almost even more menacing the fact that it's looks like it's made out of, you know, people.
Yeah, actual, you know, human material. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the things that stood out. I mean, because you just see the glove get sucked on and all of a sudden, you know, it's time to rock and roll. And here we are.
And that's one thing I've liked about, you know, like I said, Wes Craven appeared as himself in this movie, but he's not been afraid to, like, make fun of himself in, like, the public eye, too. He's got definitely a sense of humor about, you know, what he does and stuff. I mean, he's appeared on episodes of Castle. He's appeared in, like, was it the Kevin Smith, Jay and Silent Bob Strikes Back. He appears as himself directing yet another Scream sequel. And it's funny because, like, it starts off with Shannon Doherty getting chased by the Ghostface killer. And she knocks him out and takes off the mask, and it's a freaking ape. And she's like, Jesus, Wes, like, have you given up? And he's like, and you see him, he's like behind the director's chair counting like a giant stack of money. He's like, focus groups say people like monkeys now.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's, I mean, that's the thing that, you know, I think makes Wes, you know, so awesome and it's going to, you know, carry on his legacy. I mean.
And yeah, he's even done cameos in some of his movies. I mean, we'll talk about the Scream movie here in a bit, but yeah, he played a janitor at one point in one of the Scream movies. He just
he's taking that Stan Lee route, huh?
Yeah, he's like, you know, he knows he's this creepy ass dude, but he's not afraid to like make fun of that, you know, image and be out there in the public eye. And yeah, even though he's known for horror, he's even done what I would call a comedy movie. He directed Vampire in Brooklyn, which is one I did not realize was a Wes Craven movie.
Yeah, that's probably one that doesn't really fit, you know, Wes Craven's, what I would typically associate, you know, Wes Craven with. So, yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, this movie's coming out in 1995, you know, with Eddie Murphy and Angela Bassett and...
It was, I mean, he didn't write this movie, but, you know, he directed it and had, you know, John Witherspoon and all these great, like, you know, comedy guys in it. Kadeem Hardison from A Different World as Eddie Murphy's, you know, ghoul servant guy. But, I mean, for a vampire movie, it was absolutely hilarious. And that was some of probably the first ones where you've seen Eddie playing multiple, you know, characters and stuff in it, as he's known to do in just about all of his movies. But, I mean, there's some of the, like, funniest lines, because it's like, he's trying to seduce this girl and make her a vampire, but he can't just, like, feed off her. He has to make her come to him willingly, so he's trying to convince her to join him. And he does this whole thing where he finds out that she's, like, really religious. So he goes and, like, eats the preacher of the church and takes over as the preacher to try to convince her. And walks out into the church, And of course, he's a vampire, so his hair starts catching on fire. And he's like, "God damn!" And everybody starts looking at him. He's like, I mean, goddamn, anyone who wants to be inside on a night like this, we should have church out on the lawn. Gets everybody to come outside. Yeah. And then starts his whole speech of how about evil is actually good. He's like, you know, without evil, you know, there would be no good. You don't know how good is until you see how evil is. Like, he's like, for example, Brother Johnson over there, you know, he loves his wife. He's a good man. But on Thursday nights, he's over on Fifth Street getting a piece of ass. Because ass is good and evil is good. And if you get some evil ass, watch out. It's just so ridiculous.
I mean, but hey, you look at it, though. I mean, I got to say, you know, I'll just go ahead and throw it out there. If you're over religious, go ahead and fast forward for this next few seconds. But, you know, I mean, without a nemesis like Satan or something, the church wouldn't have been around for all these years.
You got to have the yin and the yang, man.
Absolutely. I don't know, it's just one of those things.
There's like another scene, too, where it's like, he's trying to, because the girl in the movie is a cop, and he's trying to get more information about her, so he, like, kind of, like, follows her in on some kind of raid and ends up in, like, some, like, mafia deal, and the cops raid, and they're, like, you know, telling everybody to, like, drop their weapons, and literally people are pulling out guns for, like, 5 minutes. There's, like, a pile of guns on the floor, and Eddie's just like, I feel a lot of love in this room.
We can have the guns, lose the crosses.
Yeah, but that's just like, you know, his tendency to, you know, step out of the stereotype, you know, and even though that horror is his, what made him famous, you know, he's willing to try shit occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, not just sticking to that same style, but I mean, you know, this is probably the film that really stands out that doesn't really fit the mantra of, you know, a lot of the other films. I don't know. But then again, you got films like Curse that, you know, all of a sudden you start having werewolves and stuff like that. So, I don't know. I just hope that wasn't some kind of sick precursor to Twilight.
How was Curse? I don't think I ever saw that one.
I mean, it was interesting. I mean, once again, this was kind of that horror comedy. I mean, it came in at a PG-13 rating, so it didn't have a whole lot of the violence and over-the-topness, but I mean, basically you had, you know, these folks that, you know, are two siblings that are attacked by a werewolf that is loose in Los Angeles. You know, the siblings go to this, you know, I'm trying to think. Basically a psychic, and, you know, they're like, let me see your hands. I see, you know, pools of blood and blah, blah, blah. Beware of the moon and all this other stuff. And they're like, man, you can't be telling people this shit. We're out. You know, basically just thinks this psychic is just batshit crazy. But, you know, she literally sees the mark of the beast. But, I mean, it follows them, you know, into their high school and everything else. And, I mean, like I said, I could almost see this being some kind of a precursor to the Twilight franchise, minus some of the vampire aspects and some of the romance.
And like I said, to go, you know, pretty far back to his early career, he also directed the original Hills Have Eyes and the sequel Hills Have Eyes too. I mean, the original came out in 1977, and that's another one where, like I said, he created a villain that was, you know, kind of attack you at your most vulnerable. I mean, it's about a group of people that end up out in the, you know, desert mountains area and gets attacked by these mutated inbred hillbilly people that, I mean, whoever's been on a road trip out in the middle of nowhere, just, you know, that's kind of one of your fears, that you'll come across one of these psycho families that time has forgotten. And
I mean, I'll put it in real-world perspective. I spent about a week in West Virginia in some coal mining towns. No internet, electricity. electricity was semi there, but it wasn't uncommon for, you know, stuff to just go dark out of nowhere for no apparent reason. But it was quite an eye-opening experience. I mean, I never really thought myself as a, you know, a city kid or anything of that nature. But when you go that far into the boondocks, you know, it really starts putting some things into perspective, and it really starts making you question, you know, people's psyches at times.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like about a family that gets stranded in the Nevada desert, and there's these people that are, you know, mutated from, you know, nuclear radiation from, you know, back in the day when, you know, they would do bombing tests out there in the desert. And yeah, it's one of those things that has like just a touch of possibility to it. I mean, it's, you know, kind of at least, you know, if not probable, at least, you know, possible. And, you know, kind of, you know, and that's something that, especially when you're going, doing like an out west road trip, you end up on those roads where you're, don't see another car or another building for like hours at a time when you're out in the middle of freaking nowhere. It's just something that, you know, there's probably a lot of people did not want to take road trips after that movie came out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, once again, you know, we see this, you know, the whole premise here is they're traveling from Ohio to LA. Like, just stop trying to go to the left coast, folks. Like,
we got Disneyland in the South, man. Yes. You know, just stay out of the West, dude. You won't get in so much trouble. I mean, that's what happened to the Donner Party, man. You try to cross the mountains, bad shit happens.
Yes. Putting it in even more realistic expectation, there we go. There's some actual history to back it up, folks.
Yeah, I mean, and The Hills Have Eyes, like, spawned two pretty successful remakes, you know, even recently, which Wes was, like, a producer on. But, yeah, I mean, those original 70s versions are just freaking absolutely creepy. I mean, they're almost kind of reminiscent of the family from Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something like,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, once again, you know, I oftentimes, you know, attribute The Hills Have Eyes to kind of that, you know, especially with, you know, the aspects of cannibalism and things of that nature. I mean, you very much see that with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre family.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably...
I mean, you definitely see that with, you know, this family as well are, you know, just these, you know, this group of cannibals,
yeah,
you
know, it's
you see a lot of inbred,
like,
you see a lot of...
Several movies. I mean, yes. Not only Texas Chainsaw, but the Wrong Turn series and just about any low-budget horror movie that involves hillbilly cannibals.
Well, I wouldn't say low-budget. I mean, I would even dare to venture to say, you know, House of a Thousand Corpses, The Devil's Rejects. I mean, I would say that those films probably played off some of the antics and everything else that we see, you know, here in, you know, The Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah, because, I mean, a movie about a serial killer is almost one thing, but when you start, even a serial killer, the screwed up stuff they do, you know, eating people seems like almost a worse taboo. Like, you know, Jason killing people with a machete is all cool and all, but if he, like, you know, opens up a stew pot and starts eating these people, that just makes it, like, 10 times worse for some reason. There's such a stigmata on cannibalism that
stigmata is there, but I think what puts it into really an over-the-top perspective is you don't just have one bad seed. You have an entire family.
Yeah.
The entire family is in on this act of cannibalism and the atrocities and everything else.
Yeah.
I think that's what makes it even more over-the-top fucked up.
Yeah, because when you start getting into... You know, I hate kids in horror movies, man, because creepy kids, like, creep me out even worse. Yeah, you know? So when you got, like, little kids trying to barbecue your ass, it's not a good day.
I used to be with you on the little kids. Little kids still creep me out. I'm starting to think, man, there's something with dolls, like, that I'm seeing a resurgence of, and I just don't fucking trust kids' dolls for shit anymore.
Oh, I had a day when I was, I had a bunch of stuff in storage, and I had these two... creepy ass ivory dolls that someone had left at my house, and I didn't throw them out. I just put them in storage with the rest of the stuff.
By someone,
I mean you jackass.
Yeah.
So when I opened the storage bin, something had shifted and fallen over. So that freaking doll comes rolling out of the door at my foot, and I cleared leather. I nearly put a round through that doll when it came, like, crawling out of the storage room at me. I was like, freaking dolls, like creepy looking dolls will freak me out every time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I saw them in broad daylight. They were still creepy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You don't want one of those things, like, falling on your foot when you're not expecting it. Like I said, I nearly put a round through it. It was
And there was
bad.
A girl in the picture, so don't just assume that Brad was playing with dolls.
Sure there was.
Just throwing it out there.
Got to defend your reputation.
Except the flaming Brad thing isn't bad enough. But apparently I don't pass the gay test, so I'm good anyway.
Oh, my God. One of the, you know, speaking of, like, the funny, weird characters he's done, something of his more recent career, which kind of, I mean, almost, if you look at, like, the top 10 highest grossing Wes Craven movies, like, the first three Scream films are at the top of those lists. I mean, those were huge movies. I mean, the first one came out in 96, which was my junior year of high school. Which, so that was kind of cool because it was about kids in high school at a time when I was in high school. So I got the characters that were involved in it. And another thing, like, you know, it was about a serial killer that called people on the phone. I mean, this was at a time when, you know, before we had smartphones, but pretty much everybody was having cell phones and stuff at that time.
There was no caller ID at that time either, folks.
So the fact that someone could just call you up and stalk you and then let you know that, you know, when Jason's, like, stalking you through the window, he doesn't know. You don't know that he's there. But with this guy, he'd be calling you up, like, what's your favorite scary movie? And start, like, quizzing you on, like, random-ass pop culture. And if you get the question wrong, you freaking die.
Damn. That's some hardcore trivia.
Like, yeah, I mean, it definitely, I would say, rejuvenated the slasher film genre. Because, like, the slasher movies kind of went away in the... you know, late 80s, early 90s, and Scream really brought it back. But it kind of made it, like, the first one was almost, like I said, the ghost face was just a, you know, now you see it everywhere, but it was just a generic Halloween costume. And that's pretty much, instead of creating a big character, he used, like, a generic Halloween costume for your killer. So it really could be absolutely anybody. And there wasn't even some kind of, like, big mythology behind it. And it was almost like not only a slasher movie, but a mystery movie as well, because you didn't really know who the killer was until that final, you know, 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to put it into perspective, dude, this film, you know, it was a, you know, $15 million budget. It made its money 11 times over. Like, It's absolutely insane how successful the Scream franchise has been.
Yeah, I mean, and made huge stars of you know, of a lot of these people.
Well, I mean, that was one thing about Scream that, you know, they used popular cast. Yeah. You know, as
Neve Campbell,
and
Courtney Cox, Drew Barrymore, David Arquette. I said Neve Campbell. I mean, she was already kind of big from a few movies, but this one right here really made her, like, you know, a big, you know, movie star at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that, you know, really stood out to me is just how many big names were in this film. You don't typically see that with a lot of horror films, you know. Yeah. You might have, you know, one or two actors that star in a, you know, a B-horror film that later on progressed to a, you know, successful career. But these people already had established careers. And
if you don't remember back when it first came out, like, all the ads and stuff featured Drew Barrymore. You thought this was going to be a Drew Barrymore movie, and she's, like, dead in the first, like, 15 minutes of the film.
Yes. But, I mean, you know, another thing about this film is I love the parodies and the spinoffs that came out, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we've got the Scary Movie franchise was based off of Scream. I mean, and there's been so many references to it in other works. And not only that, it's so self-referential and kind of makes fun of the whole, you know, horror genre. I mean, there is even one character by was it Jamie Kennedy, who is, like, the quote unquote horror movie expert, and he's like, and he's the one that's like, this killer is killing people based on horror movie rules. You know, if you don't want to die, you have to live by the rules. Like, rule number one, you can't have sex. Only the virgins survive the horror movie. And whatever you do, don't say I'll be back, because you won't.
Yes. I mean, but.
Which was true. We've talked about in some of our, yes, there's that, you know, the original horror stuff had that morality aspect where you can't have sex, you can't do drugs, you can't drink, or you're gonna die. And like I said, this movie just, like, you know, flat out said that. It was no longer a reference that, you know, us horror geeks get. It was like, you know, they put that shit on Front Street. Like, here are the rules to the game.
If only they had did that with the Saw films.
And, you know, Matthew Lillard, too, was, you know, he was pretty hilarious. He was, like, and that's probably one of his first movies, and he's gone on to be in a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. The Scream franchise, I mean, it's something that is always going to... I mean, I don't know. Was Ghostface Killah around? Or did, you know, he get his, you know, rap name and everything else based on the Scream films?
I think the Ghostface Killah was already... That's Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang ain't nothing to fuck with.
So, I mean, you know, there you go. You got Wes Craven taking... Man, this guy ain't nothing to fuck with. Neither is this guy.
And really, like, so Ghostface is something people came up with. I mean, they never actually give the character a name in the movies. And that was kind of cool about, you know, with this one, with a lot of sequelized horror movies, it's always the same killer coming back. But with this being just a generic-ass, you know, costume, we had a different killer in each movie. So even though there's a new movie, you're like, you can't tell who the killer is because...
Yeah, I mean, you just have a bunch of copycats.
It's a new person, you know, wearing the get-up and going after these people. Like, with the first movie, it turned out to be, like, Sidney, Neve Campbell's character's boyfriend and his friend, who were basically douchebags that just wanted to be famous. Like, that was their whole motivation for all this, was like...
Well, I mean, unfortunately, you know, I'm going to bring it back to reality, but a lot of times that's why people commit such heinous crimes and stuff like that, is because that's the only way people are going to remember them and their, you know, fucked up mentality or their psyche or whatever, is, you know, to do something so heinous that... You know, my name is going to, you know, be remembered forever. You know, I mean, I don't know. You know, I oftentimes, you know, wonder, you know, we've talked about the Ed Geins, the Jeffrey Dahmers. I mean, how many serial killers, you know, and people look at that as a legacy and say, I want that for myself. Like,
yeah. Oh, and then
you're
like,
fucked up. You need a 45 round through your skull.
And, you know, Courtney Cox's character in this was like the typical exploitive media person who is, you know, trying to become famous by, you know, covering this serial killer, you know, thing going on. And yeah, it's just, you know, so many like false positives where like, oh, this has got to be the killer. And that person usually ends up dead 5 minutes later. I mean, and they even threw in Freddy Krueger in this, like Robert Englund, I think, makes a cameo as like a teacher or something. So you're like, oh, freaking Robert Englund's in this. He's got to be the killer. But no, it's... It's like, I think after Freddy, there's a whole series of films that just put him in there to throw you off. So you didn't know who the real character killer was.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think it's also just a throwback to... I mean, you've had such a successful franchise of the Freddy Krueger films. Why not bring them into the mix, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you got to have those references and things of that nature. I mean, that's almost as good as, you know... I mean, we go and see a Marvel movie. We almost expect there to be a Stan Lee cameo in every film. I mean, why not have the same thing for the horror genre?
Yeah. And when the second one came out, like I said, they were now college kids. And whatever, Courtney Cox's character had become famous by writing a book about the original murders. And now all of a sudden, the killer is back killing, you know, once again, you know, going after Neve Campbell's character, but now she's a college student, and you don't know if it's her boyfriend or whatnot doing the killing. And I think it ends up being the original killer's mother is now trying to take revenge, but it's another one of those that you don't know who did it until it's like that. He did a good combination of combining that comedy, mystery, and horror all together into one.
Well, one thing
I
thought was interesting when it comes to Scream 2 is apparently the script was leaked. So this film had to go through extensive rewrites and everything else to, you know, try to, you know, make the killer anonymous and everything of that nature. So, you know, I thought that was one interesting aspect that, you know, trying to change the identity of the killers and, you know, their motivation and everything else, trying to keep that intact.
Yeah, and that was another thing, too, because Liv Schreiber was in this one, and he was in there for a little bit in the first one. He was, like, supposed to be someone who killed the Neve Campbell's character's mom, and then you find out it was really her boyfriend, because her mom was having an affair with his dad. So he shows up just trying to get, like, hey, you sent me to prison, because she was, like, the witness against him and stuff, and trying to just kind of get an apology out of her. So you like automatically assume he's like out for revenge because he's been in prison all this time, and he ends up kind of becoming the hero of the movie and like saving everybody's lives and stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, the theme of Scream 2 as far as the music aspect, I mean, those are things that really stand up, you know, and things of that nature. You know, the awards, the nominations, everything else that, you know, Scream 2 received. I mean, I don't know, you know, I mean, it reached number 50 on the Billboard 200, so...
Yeah, and the the Scream series is probably one of my favorite horror movie franchises, just because of how funny it is and how self-referential it is to the horror genre. Even Jamie Kennedy's back and has like whole theory like, oh, now we're dealing with a sequel, so the rules have changed. There's like pretty much anybody can be killed now and all this other stuff, and you know, he doesn't make it through this movie. But you see in the third franchise, now they've made a movie based on the book, based on the original murders. So now they're like, you know, it's even more self-referential because someone's making a copycat of the copy and, you know, the movie killer that the original guys were kind of copying.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's even a cameo by Jay and Silent Bob. They're because they're on like a Hollywood tour of the set, and you see... freaking Jay and Silent Bob on one of the tour groups like says something to like freaking Courtney Cox when they come by. So it's like, it's just so weird that it's
I mean, that's one of the things about Scream 3 is that it provided that slasher genre aspect, but it also threw that comedy on top of it that you really didn't have that comedy aspect in the previous two films. Like, this film was almost in a way kind of making fun of the previous two films, which I think really opened the door for, you know, some of the, you know, parody films that we've seen.
Yeah, like in the movie, within the movie, is called Stab 3, which is based off the other two movies. So yeah, and of course, like, you know, Jamie Kennedy's character shows up in a film because he's like, yeah, just in case something happens to me and I die and this continues on, here are the rules for a trilogy. Like, there are no more rules. Anybody can be the killer. It may be more than one killer. The body count's going to be huge. And it was kind of cool that, you know, he brought that the guy who tells the rules character back to the third one, despite being dead at this point in the series.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I really wish I had an opportunity to see, the Scream franchise more recently, because it has been a number of years since I've seen
the first three are on Netflix. So if you don't know what we're talking about, go watch them.
Yes. And if you haven't seen them, spoiler alert, 47 minutes into the segment. Oops.
Yeah. These things are like freaking 20 years old now. So it's, if you haven't seen them, you're on your own. Screw you. Your spoiler alerts.
I just thought I'd throw it out there. I mean, that way people can't say that we didn't.
There has definitely got to be a time limit on spoiler alerts now.
Like, you want to be a geek or a nerd, you got to be up to the minute. You wait more than two days.
They killed Jaws at the end of... No, fuck you. If you've not seen something, you know, 20 years ago...
Wait, they killed Jaws?
Yeah.
What?
Brody shot a air tank in his mouth and he goes boom.
No.
Smile, you motherfucker. Smile, you son of a bitch, I think is the line. Yeah, just go back and watch
it. We got a Piranha 3D. We can't have a Jaws 4D.
Come on. Hey, according to Back to the Future, there's something, Jaws 13 or something, so it's been out by now. And we've only had four. Y'all got to catch up, people.
So, yeah, I mean, this one was kind of interesting, too, because, using the voice changer, like, I wonder if that sets the stage for some auto-tune.
Oh, yeah. Like, how many, like, freaking voice changers did you see in, like, stores because of this movie? I mean, just about every Spencer's Gifts had a freaking, like, Scream voice changer thing.
Well, I mean, I saw that. I mean, hell, we still got cell phone apps that do that. I mean, shit, I do that even with, like, our blowing smoke segment and stuff. Yeah. Like, if not for this film, I probably wouldn't have thought, like, let me slow this down and drop it a few octaves and see what happens.
Yeah, and again, like I said, that whole you don't know who to trust because it could be, you know, your best friend.
At this point, anybody,
killer.
Yes.
Yeah. And like I said, with that generic ghost face as the killer, you know, it's a cool way to to mix it up, so you're definitely not expecting it, time and time again. And like this franchise really made David Arquette a huge actor, because he was the goofy deputy Dewey in the first movie, and he kind of all these characters kind of evolved into he really became a badass by the third one. Neve Campbell's character, who was the virginal victim in the first movies, she's kind of learned to be a tough woman through the series of films. And
I think that's one thing that I liked about
with all their characters.
You can definitely see the character growth, and I think that's what allowed the Scream franchise to be so successful. Is it wasn't just the same dumb stunts every time around. It was you were different challenges, but you've learned from the past challenges, and you can apply some of that knowledge to what's going on currently. So, for it to be such a simplistic concept of, let's just put a killer behind a ghost mask, there's actually a lot of complexity that goes behind that. And I think that's what has allowed this franchise to blossom.
Yeah. And then even had a Scream 4, which unfortunately I've not seen. I mean, it came out in 2011, 11 years after the last movie. So I'm not 100% sure what it's about, but that was, the last movie Wes Craven directed. He was still improving on his franchise.
Yeah, absolutely. I reading here in my notes, originally the series was intended to be a trilogy, but the film production was approved and everything else, so we got the fourth film. Basically, we have, the 15th anniversary of the Woodsboro Massacre. Jenny Randall, Marnie Cooper, and are attacked and brutally murdered by a new ghost faced. So, basically we start that whole sequence of events all over again. I probably haven't seen Scream 4 since it came out, so everything isn't as fresh in my head as I would like it to be. So this may be one that we need to...
I'm going to have to go watch this after, because I never got around to seeing Scream 4. But at least it was a sequel and not a reboot, because we all know reboots suck.
Yeah. What's a good reboot? Can you think of any?
No. I don't know. The Total Recall reboot was not bad. It was actually fairly decent. As long as you... And the RoboCop 2, as long as you don't go in judging them based on the originals, I think they're good standalone movies if you don't try to compare them to the original versions. But they're just enough homage to the originals that it was pretty good. I didn't mind reboots when it was stuff that was so old, really didn't have a big home video release, but stuff that's I can watch on TV now. I don't really need a reboot of it because I've already seen that story.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I kind of felt that same way about...
Rebooting stuff from the 50s is okay. Rebooting stuff from 10 years ago is just kind of lazy.
Yes. That's my feeling. I kind of felt that way going into Ninja Turtles after Michael Bay directed it. I mean, if you watch the film from a standalone film, it's likable. If you try to compare it to the comics and the original films, not so much.
All right. As we kind of come to a close here, and hopefully no one will pop out of the closet and kill us. Final thoughts on the career of Mr. Wes Craven?
I mean, he's had so many influences, and he's going to be a name that's going to live on forever. I mean, and in my opinion, George Carlin is a big name that's always near and dear to my heart. Wes Craven is also another one of those individuals. I mean, I have kids and they're old enough. Best believe they're going to be watching Freddy Krueger with me. They're going to be afraid to go to sleep. They're going to have those same apprehensiveness that I experienced.
Just because we didn't sleep as a kid, you shouldn't sleep either. And
payback's a bitch.
Final thoughts on this cigar?
This is one of my, I think it's going to be my all new go-to. I mean, the Super Lajero definitely still has a place in my heart, but this switches it up. It brings a little bit more complexity to the table, and there's it's new, it's fresh. I'm going to be going back to this thing time and time again, and it's not just because I got a box in my humidor.
Yeah, with the Lajero having this straight-up strength, this one I think has not as much strength, but it has a lot more flavor. There's definitely a more complex flavor to this cigar, where you're not only getting the strength, but you're also getting, you know, a real enjoyable flavor, and you know, it's just not overpowering. It's like I said, it's well balanced strength and flavor for me. So yeah, this, once they become more available, since everywhere is currently sold out, I highly recommend this smoke. And as always, if you go pick up something we've talked about on the show, a beer, cigar, whatever, tell the people we sent you. Let them know that, like, you know, we're out there talking about people, and you know, help spread the legend of the Cigar Nerds. And definitely go you know, see all of Wes Craven's movies again, just, you know, to, as a good remembrance for the man who has frightened us all since we were little children, and even at this point frightened our parents and frightened our kids, or, you know, those of you that have them. He's definitely going to leave a long-lasting mark on the world of not only horror, but, you know, pop culture in general.
Absolutely.
And with that, stay tuned, folks. We have a Rocky Patel interview coming up, and some Beer 30, some science, and some recap of our Dragon Con debauchery coming up, so stay tuned.
Let's go before you. Three, four, and up to the
today with the man, the myth, legend, Mr. Rocky Patel. How you doing today, sir?
I'm great. Great to be here with you guys.
Yeah, thanks for sitting down with us. We're kind of celebrating the release of the is it the Select Reserve
20th anniversary and Sun Grown Maduro.
Yeah, that Sun Grown Maduro, I've had like a couple of those tonight, and that's a damn good cigar. What's kind of the inspiration behind it?
Well, we wanted to make a true Sun Grown cigar that basically has a lot of character. It's a very rich cigar. It's bold. It's got a lot of caramel, coffee, chocolate, nutmeg, almond with some hints of spice. And it's a broadleaf wrapper that's been aged for 6 years from Connecticut. It's got Nicaraguan fillers from our farm and two different binders. So that cigar's got a lot of character. I'm very proud of it. And then we also released our 20th anniversary. I can't believe that it's been 20 years in the business, but when I look in the mirror and I see my gray hair, I realize why. But the 20th anniversary is actually medium-bodied. It's got a lot of complexity, a lot of flavor, but it's elegant and well-balanced at the same time.
Yeah, I've not had a chance to get my hands on that 20-year yet. I'm looking forward to trying that one out. Yeah, I realized we did a little art project where I made a table with all my cigar wrappers. And so when I started going through all my labels, I was like, there's a lot of Rock Patel in this batch. So. This
well, good.
Yeah, the
I don't even know how many boxes of Super Lajeros.
Yeah, Super Lajero is like.
Oh, so Super Lajero, you tried those? Oh, yeah, that's really cool. What most people don't realize, the Super Lajero has a hybrid seed from Costa Rica, and the Plasencia family was working for 4 years to build this hybrid seed, and they came up with the brand Super Lajero and the seed Super Lajero. So that makes up about 45% to 50% of the filler, and that's what gives this cigar a unique taste. And that cigar, again, has a lot of character, but it's very spice-forward, peppery-forward, but it's got the depth and roundness of a rich cigar.
Yeah, that's one of my current, like, regular go-to smokes. It's just, I like the strength of it, but then there's also so much, like, flavor and complexity to it that it's, I mean, it's a great all-around smoke.
I think my first cigar when I first got started was the Edge. That was like my first regular smoke. Just that sign on the box said for serious cigar smokers only. I'm like, that's a challenge. I'm gonna have to get that.
I mean, the Edge, I call it our blue collar cigar. It's our workhorse. It's one of our best selling cigars, and you know, we make the Edge now, obviously, in the Costa Rican Maduro wrapper and the Corolla wrapper. Then we have the Nicaraguan Puro in it that's released, and the Sumatra wrapper. And we've released the Edge now. We traditionally had it in the Toros and Torpedos. Now we have the B52, which is a great size. It's a short, big ring gauge. And then, of course, we have the 6x52. So the Edge has become, I think it's a staple out there.
I mean, like I said, you're coming up with on the, you know, the 20 year anniversary. I mean, what's some lessons you've learned in all this time? Because you've been through the start of the boom till today.
Well, it's been a lot of hard work, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of work on the road burning shoe leather. And, you know, the most difficult challenge is all the legislation that we face. Yeah. FDA, state taxes, federal taxes, anti-smoking regulation. I literally spend over 50% of my time, whether it's Washington, D.C., fighting the FDA regulation, meeting congressmen, lobbying with Congress, lobbying with Senate, or being on the state level and fighting for lower taxes, anti-smoking regulation. So I'm busy, and it sucks because I truly believe that I'm an official government employee. Because, I mean, not only do we pay high taxes, but I'm spending over 50% of my time away from my business just trying to protect the industry.
And that's, I mean, you don't see a lot of people, you know, trying to protect everyone, not just, you know, your own company. And that's something that, you know, as a smoker, I appreciate, because I was talking to Stacy here earlier about some of the stuff they're proposing. And, like, man, that's going to kill not only the small business, but when you're limited on the new stuff you can come out with, that just kind of kills innovation. And
yeah, I mean, for example, here we are in Cummings, Georgia, Tim's shop, the cigar shop, and imagine you couldn't go into his humidor and you couldn't look at a cigar, you couldn't touch a cigar, you couldn't feel a cigar. You basically have no self-service. So you'd walk into Tim's shop and you'd get a black and white sheet paper handed to you, and you literally have to pick a cigar from that, and that's what they want. And most of this legislation is being proposed by Altria, Philip Morris, and companies like that, because the way they look at it is people will remember the big brands, which is Marlboro and Marlboro Light. And also some of the big cigar companies, I'm not going to mention names, they're for the regulation, because they believe that people will buy a Macanudo, Romeo, Monte Cristo, Cohiba, because if you don't look at a cigar and you just get a black and white sheet of paper handed to you, that's what they want. They want a barrier to entry to the market, and they're trying to wipe out all the little guys like us so the big guys survive. So, you know, it's a scary thing, but, you know, we're going to fight this, and we're going to fight it till we win. And we want people to realize that premium cigars are different. Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. You wouldn't buy a bottle of wine, a single malt scotch, bourbon, rye whiskey, whatever, without trying it. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's the time we face. And big corporate America is against us. Also, Tobacco Free Kids, American Cancer Society, American Lung Association, World Health Organization. So these are very heavily armed forces that are fighting us. And the difference is that premium cigars are unique. It is something that has transcended over generations. And by the time we plant a seedling in the ground, time we get a cigar in a box takes 4 to 5 years, 300 different hands to touch the tobacco. There are no youth access issues. You come in this beautiful store and you have people of all races, all religions, blue collar, white collar. Everybody smokes a cigar, and it actually brings people together. In the day of Facebook and Twitter, where nobody has a conversation and they're busy. I remember when I had dinner, like when I was growing up, you had dinner, there was no tweeting, there was no texting, there was no television, and you hung out with the family. Now our lives are so busy. Well, premium cigar gets you all together, you relax, you can have a conversation about life, politics, sports, or you can just sit back and meditate and daydream. So that's the beauty about what's going on with the premium cigar industry.
Yeah, that's one thing. Like, most people that aren't premium cigar smokers don't realize there's a difference between this and, like, the machine-made cigarettes coming off the line. This is not a, you know, two-pack-a-day Marlboro habit. I mean, it's the experience that goes along with it. It's not, you don't smoke cigars just to smoke a cigar. I mean, you do to sit down with your friends and have a good time. I mean,
that's the whole reason our podcast and everything else came about is, you know, what are we doing? We're sitting around socializing. We're bringing people into the mix. It's a good engagement and interaction with folks.
And these
that's
are
what cigar culture brings to the table. The difference from, I mean, so many other industries out there, like you said, you know, cigarette smoking. I do that on my own, away from everybody. And, you know, I do that because I'm in a rush. When I sit down with a premium cigar, I'm taking that load off.
Or it's a habit.
I'm indulging it.
And premium cigars are not a habit. You relax, you enjoy, you celebrate, you pick the occasion, and that's the beauty about it.
Yeah, and it's still a handmade product from, you know, the farming of the tobacco to the rolling of the cigars. And when you sit down with these people that are in the industry like yourself, I mean, you see the passion behind the products. And
absolutely. You know, the amount of detail, workmanship, labor, love, and passion that goes into making a premium cigar is unparalleled. And it is much harder to make a cigar than make a car. And there's so much work that goes into making a cigar. It's truly a labor of love.
So, yeah, definitely people write your congressmen, whatever, and like I said, to help protect.
Join CRA, Cigar Rights of America. The website is cigarrights.org. 100% of the money goes towards protecting your freedoms, rights, and privileges to enjoy a cigar.
Like I said, like that's without that, we wouldn't have events like we're at today and being able to sit down, you know, smoke a cigar with the man that's responsible for it all. And we really appreciate you.
And we have Stacy.
Oh, yeah.
our wonderful, talented, absolutely great representative for the Rocky Patel brand, Stacy.
Yeah.
So tell people what you have to face all the time when you're on the streets and what you deal with.
Well, hello. I'm Stacy, and I am the Rocky Patel representative for the state of Georgia and Eastern Tennessee. And I think probably the hardest thing that I deal with or encounter on a day-to-day basis is I get a lot of consumers that are like, Cuba's open. When do I get my Cuban? And I'm like, okay, let me tell you, you little naive smoker that you don't know that much about cigar industry, because I would have been the same way, don't get me wrong. You know,
we get that question ourselves.
When I started,
I
actually was a cigarette smoker myself. And I really actually knew nothing about the cigar industry. So when I came on board, I was completely open to... I cold turkey quit cigarettes, went over to cigars. I got to go down to our factories in Honduras, Nicaragua, and I learned the whole trade. And I kind of just went out on my own, and I'm friends with a lot of the reps in the area, so I've kind of tried other products so I can help place the consumer with, okay, tell me what you smoke. It doesn't have to be necessarily Rocky Patel, but I can put you in the right direction of what will be close to your palate. And as far as the Cuba thing goes, I mean, you know, when that whole legislation came back, everyone just expects, oh, I can get Cubans now. And that's not how it works. I mean, yes, if you are there on like a visa, you can bring back up to $100 of rum and Cubans. But a lot of people don't realize that Cuba, yes, has ideal conditions for tobacco to be grown. But at the end of the day, they don't have the heart and the soul that we have. And I'm not saying just us. There's other manufacturers out there. You know, we're an industry together. But as Rocky stated, I mean, our quality control, every single cigar goes through so many different testings to make sure that the wrappers match, that the ring gauges are the same size, that everything is consistent. And Rocky basically re-blends every cigar that a lot of people don't know. Typically, our primings are broken down into three different primings. We've got the Seiko, we've got the Viso, we've got the Lajero. That's what most people know. Rocky actually likes to break it down into about 8 different primings. And every time we do a crop, he re-blends that cigar, and that's how you get that consistency. Because you won't get consistent cigars if you use the exact same priming every season, because you can't dictate what the weather's going to be like, what the climate's going to be, what kind of soil you're going to have. et cetera. There's a lot of things that go into it. And so what Rocky does is completely different from anyone else in the industry, because he basically goes and re-blends that cigar to make sure that it's consistent, because maybe that priming he used last year is not going to be consistent with the priming this year. So he has to tweak it a little bit to give you that consistent flavor.
Yeah, it's almost comparative to, like, the wine industry. Because, like,
exactly.
It's not, I mean, the weather, the soil, the seed. I mean, all there's so many things that will affect
the
taste of that plant from year to year. Just because it's the same plant don't mean it's going to taste the same each
year.
Well, yeah, it's ironic in the wine industry. They expect the vintage to be different year to year. Well, the same principle applies in the cigar industry. The same crop with the same seedling from the same farm from the rainy season is different from the same crop with the same seed from the same farm from the dry season. The crop from the rainy season doesn't have as much strength as the crop from the dry season. And whether you're smoking a decade, edge, vintage, whatever you're smoking, people expect the taste to be exactly the same year to year, box to box. So we're always tweaking the priming. If it's the fifth priming, the sixth priming, I might have to go to the seventh or eighth priming. If it's the rainy season, I might have to go to the third or fourth priming. If it's a dry season. So like a mad scientist, we're always playing around with the primings to get it right. And what Stacy alluded to about the Cubans, it's the forbidden fruit. Exactly. Just like when you couldn't get Coors beer east of the Rockies, everybody wanted it. There's nothing special. No. The reality with the Cubans is, the soil is under there's not enough nutrients. They don't have money for fertilizer. The biggest problem with the Cubans is they don't spend the 4 to 5 years it takes for tobacco to cure and ferment. They rush the process in a year, year and a half. Instead of making 250 cigars per day, they make 500 to 700 a day. Half the cigars are plugged. So you're getting cigars that don't have a good draw, that are plugged. There's no doubt Cuban tobacco is distinct and unique, just like Nicaraguan, just like Honduran, just like Dominican. But don't try to tell me that Cuban cigars are great. They're not. And the reality is the fakes are better. So there's going to be a long time before people actually get Cuban cigars. And if you smoke them, God bless you.
Yeah, I've managed to have a couple. And they're no better than, like, the Dominican, Honduran, Nicaraguan. Yeah. I mean, I enjoy that. If not as much better than, I mean, it's just the fact that you want the bragging rights saying, oh yeah, I've smoked a Cuban.
But it's, right.
Like, yeah. I said, there's the stuff you can get here is better than a lot of the stuff you find coming out of there if you can get your hands on it. And half the fakes are, you know, Dominican Honduran anyway. Right. So
yeah,
somebody slapping a label on whatever they can get a hold of. But yeah, that's one thing I enjoy is the consistency with your cigars, because like I said, I've been smoking the Edge for a long, and like I said, no matter how many different boxes I try, it's pretty much the same cigar every time.
Right.
Well, we work very hard to make sure our cigars are very consistent. We have some of the strictest quality control standards implemented in our factory that anybody has, and we're proud of it. And I think one thing you'll recognize when you smoke a Rocky Patel is that it's always consistent in quality, and it'll guarantee the level of consistency that you get.
Absolutely. I've never had a bad experience, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, the Cipoleros and a lot of the Patel cigars that I've smoked have been so wonderful, is I don't have the issues that I do with a lot of other folks. You know, unfortunately, a lot of times you get the marketing aspect of, oh, it's a boutique or something of that nature, and, you know, at the end of the day, that's just an excuse for somebody to charge you more for a lesser product.
Exactly. And then you get those guys that are on back order, and then once you get that cigar, it's a completely different flavor than what you had originally.
Well, you know, in this industry, the hardest part to get the consistency is you got to have a rich inventory of tobacco. At any one time, we're sitting on $18 to $20 million worth of tobacco that's curing and fermenting. And many times we stop production on a particular brand like Decade or Edge for 3 or 4 months because one leaf needed more time in fermentation. So it's the old adage, you can't make chicken salad out of chicken shit, and you got to have the inventory. And when you're one of these boutique guys that are buying tobacco one day from here and one day from here and one day from here, it's very difficult. Not only do we have our own farms, but we contract out with the biggest growers like the Plasencias, like the Olivas, like ASP. They are some of the biggest growers of tobacco around the world. We contract out 2 to 3 years and tell them how many thousands of pounds of tobacco we need for the next growing season, so we have it every year. Then that tobacco comes in, we spend 3 to 4 to 5 years curing it, fermenting it, aging it, sitting on it, so we had that consistency in every single blend. And people always say, Rocky, you make so many different blends, you do so much, because we're capable of doing that because we have so many tobaccos from Nicaragua, from three regions, Esteli, Jalapa, Condega. We have from Honduras, Hamastron, St. Augustine, Olancho, Talanga, from Ecuador, Sumatra seed, Habano seed, Connecticut seed. We have African Cameroon, from Dominican, Alor, Dominican Piloto. We have broadleaf from Pennsylvania, broadleaf from Connecticut. We have tobacco from Brazil. We have Matafina. We have San Andreas Mexican wrapper. So, and I can go on and on, but we have so many different gradations of tobacco that we've been collecting for a long time, aging it, and we have a constant supply of that to make sure our cigars are consistent, and that's what it takes. It's a big investment.
How many days out of the year are you on the road, like, supporting this? somewhere, like, every day.
Almost 300, you know, between fighting in Washington, regulation, being at the factories, being on the road, doing events like this. It's almost 300 days a year.
That's a busy schedule.
Yeah, I thought I had it hard. Compared to Rocky, it is completely different.
Yeah, you just have to deal with us here in, like, Georgia and Tennessee.
Exactly.
You've got the world to deal with, and we appreciate your time. We'll let you get back to the party. Like I said, thank you for your time, and we, like I said, really appreciate your cigars.
My pleasure. Great to meet with you guys, and good luck with your podcast.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hey, man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back. It's time for Beer 30. What are we drinking this week, Brad?
We are drinking Clown Shoes Billionaire. Pierre Ferrand. This is the second incarnation of the Billionaire beer, but this has been aged in 30-year-old cognac bottles, barrels purchased from Pierre Ferrand. And as you can tell, after only a few sips at 12%, this beer is already having an impact.
Yeah, it's definitely a stout beer. Like I said, it's officially a barley wine because it is, you know, 12%. Is that dark brown in color, but yeah, you definitely taste the cognac influences. It's very, got a very alcoholy flavor to it,
and that's one thing that I always enjoy about a barley wine is you have that alcohol. You know, before I got really big into craft beer and you know, drink beer properly, I guess is the way to put it without becoming a beer snob.
Too late.
You know, I was always much more of a hard liquor drinker, and that was one reason that beer kind of didn't do it for me, as I knew beer to be, because it didn't have that warmth and, you know, that full mouthfeel that you get from a bourbon or a whiskey or something of that nature. So, you know, this is right up my alley. You know, barley wines were kind of my segue into the craft beer scene. So, you know, for me, I'm really enjoying this beer. And it's kind of cool, too. you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely got like a sweet fruit aroma to it. You know, and it's, like I said, it's definitely had that cognac taste.
Yeah, I mean, this is very winey tasting to me. I'll let Rachel try it. Apparently, it is not as wine tasting to her, but... Since I am not a wine connoisseur, I oftentimes miss out on, you know, you know, when you get people that are hardcore into wine and they're talking about all this stuff, I don't pick up on those flavors with wine the way I do a beer. But, you know, I'm also getting some caramel notes. I mean, there's almost a sweetness on the back end of this. So I would say it's complex, you know, and my palate isn't being influenced by a cigar or anything of that nature. You know, the lacing on the glass is there. It looks awesome. You know, had very good head retention. I mean, overall, I don't know. I mean, this is a beer, had it not been so hard to find, you know, something I'd like to drink more of.
Yeah, so that's the problem when you get into some of these limited release beers. You only get them, like, seasonally, so if you don't catch them while they're in stores, you're just shit out of luck.
Yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts? I mean, you enjoying the beer overall, or?
Yeah, it's got a nice, you know, warming to it. It's maybe a good little bit colder weather beer, you know, because the alcohol definitely warms you up. But yeah, it has you know, like I said, you do have the alcohol taste, but also like a, almost like a raisiny, like, you know, dried fruity flavor to it.
Absolutely. And I like the artwork on the bottle too. I mean, it just makes you feel like a billionaire just looking at that label of all the billion-dollar bills and stuff that are there.
Yeah, Clown Shoes makes some pretty good beers. I mean, they you know, have a lot of, they have their regulars, and then they come out with these random seasonal releases that are, you know, kind of innovative and different than your normal everyday beers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What are you thinking as far as your untapped skill or scale? Wow.
And you've just started drinking. I'll give this one maybe a 375.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm at a 4.5, but, you know, I dig a barley wine. I don't mind, you know, some of the fruity flavors and, you know, the higher ABV and the, you know, overall alcohol taste.
So, yeah, I mean, by the second glass, I would probably be pretty good buzzing, so it would probably improve the more you drink of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, at 12%, it doesn't take a whole lot.
Yeah, I'm not a big barley wine drinker, but yeah, after a couple, you don't care what it tastes like.
It's almost like an IPA, right? After that, you know, fifth or sixth one, all of a sudden the bitterness and everything just subsides and you no longer taste anything. You're just drunk.
Yeah. And with that, I guess we will be right back.
Stay tuned, folks.
Yes, science! And welcome back to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. It's time for some science! You ready to learn some shit, Brad?
Oh yeah, dude.
You're like, you know, you sure your brain's not, you know, too soft? You're ready. You're ready to add some more, you know, connective tissue.
I don't know, man.
Neural pathways, like, and shit.
I kind of feel like Dragon Con might have did a disservice to my knowledge bank. There's definitely some mush left over from the con.
Oh yeah, Concrete will do that to you. All right. First on our list of cool things. As we know, 1985 is the year of
my birth.
I mean, not 1985. 2015 is the year of Back to the Future. And we all were hoping we'd have hoverboards, and there's a few companies who have been working on it. We've talked about a few of that in the past. But one of the companies that we have spoke about, Arx Pax, which made the Hendo hoverboard that we talked about, that basically will levitate on a kind of like a metal half pipe type thing. Well, they've actually just signed a agreement with NASA to work on tractor beam technology.
Interesting.
So, you know, you can trap your...
So we can straight up beam me up, Scotty?
No, not that kind of beam. This is like the beam that, like, trapped the Millennium Falcon and sucked it into the Death Star.
Ah, okay. That kind of tractor beam.
Yeah.
I don't want to be sucked up against my will. I don't think. I don't know. Maybe there's some pretty cool outer space raves going on or something that I'm unaware of. But,
well, part of what their hoverboard operates on is something they call magnetic field architecture, or MFA technology, and basically it creates a controllable magnetic field and also a opposing magnetic field to cushion the hoverboard.
All right, I got to stop you. MFA technology.
Yes.
Does that just stand for motherfucking awesome?
No, it stands for magnetic field architecture.
I'm going to go for motherfucking awesome.
Okay, yeah. Well, NASA is wanting to develop this stuff. They've signed what they call a Space Act Agreement with Arx Pax to use their MFA technology device to build a working tractor beam so they can manipulate and move microsatellites without actually having to physically touch them. You know, like now when a shuttle or whatever the next space vehicle goes up into space to launch something, you know, it has to, you know, they have like these robotic arms and stuff that will like pull it out of the ship and you know, have to like actually grab onto it. And when you're talking about a multi-million, maybe billion-dollar device, when something touches it, it's, you know, the potential for damage, or even if you're launching it from a rocket and then, you know, forcing it out into space with some kind of like explosive device, being able to use an actual tractor beam to reach out and grab it and pull it in, or to launch it from the spacecraft, it'd be a lot safer for, you know, for the equipment.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, high end equipment like that, I mean, the last thing you want to do is have something, you know, come along and fuck it up. Saves us taxpayers in the long run.
Also, I mean, it would definitely have, like construction potential and stuff, or like if we build some kind of like space-based manufacturing, you know, it's gonna be a whole lot easier to move stuff around using that technology than instead of having, you know, because cranes aren't going to work very well in a weightless environment. But if
even outside the weightless environment, I mean, you know, imagine having this technology just from an engineering standpoint. I mean, I could see a lot of practical uses for that. So,
yeah, one of the things NASA is working on is they call it their autonomous rendezvous and docking manipulation. So it's like basically, I said some kind of like space drones being able to move equipment and materials around without having to physically touch them. And like I said, you know, it was some kind of like, you know, robotic technology where we, you know, we're basically, we can have drones building stuff in space. This is, you know, going to be a huge impact for that.
Oh yeah.
For that stuff.
No,
plus
definitely
it's cool
because
it's Star Wars in real life.
Yeah. Which is always a blessing. So I don't know, man. I'm really curious to see, you know, how far this goes and, you know, the potential groundbreaking impacts it has to have. So pretty cool that we're on the, you know, the cutting edge cuff of some of this stuff. I mean, this is things that, you know, looking back at it over the years, folks only, you know, were dreaming of, not really knowing when things like this may come to fruition. So,
yeah, I mean, if it gets me a hoverboard faster, so be it.
At a decent price.
Yeah. Speaking of, you know, stuff in space, we've spoke earlier about different experiments with aging whiskey in space and whatnot. Well, there's a company who has built a space glass that allows you to drink whiskey in orbit.
Hell yeah. A toast to these guys.
Yeah, because if you've ever seen videos from the space station or whatever, liquids just kind of turn into like, you know, just like a floating ball of goo, you know, because they're not even going to sit in a glass. Most time, astronauts now, you know, drinks and stuff are in these, you know, sacks, really, that you would have like a valve on it where you just kind of suck it like an old Capri Sun bag or something.
I think the closest thing I've seen to that is, you know, a lot of times in maximum security prisons and stuff like that where inmates aren't allowed to have plastic and things of that nature. That's pretty much what they're limited to consuming beverages from.
Yeah, they're almost like drinking from like IV bags. Well, a whiskey company called Ballantine's commissioned the Open Space Agency's James Barr to produce a glass that can be used in space, and it's
a glass, but it's not a glass.
It's a 3D printed using medical grade plastics that looks basically like your regular whiskey tumbler, except that it has a convex stainless steel base coated in rose gold, which is a non-reactive thing, and the liquid will stick to it almost like, you know, a magnet, so it'll actually stay in the glass and not float around the station. And then in the glass, there's these little grooves going up to another gold piece that's kind of like on the rim of the glass, which is where you'll actually drink from. And the inertia of moving the glass actually forces the liquid into these channels and up to the drinking spot.
And as Bill and I said, inertia is a property of matter.
But yeah, especially now that we're kind of getting into the commercial space exploration where we may eventually have space tourism and stuff, this is going to be something cool where you can, you know, have a glass of whiskey on whatever bar of whatever luxury space liner you happen to end up on.
Yeah. Golly, man. I know what certain bottles go for in Las Vegas where folks are dropping, you know, close to $100,000 on a single bottle. Like, I could only imagine on a space tour, like, how much is your average tumbler of whiskey going to go for in that environment? Like that. And we had a small explosion.
Yeah. It's with the whiskey stuck to the bottom of the glass. You get drunk, you're not going to spill it. You drop your glass, it's just going to float there. I mean, I need that here now.
I'll work on creating a anti-gravity, field here in the basement. That way, you know, we can just float around and, you know, the worst we'll have to worry about some bumps on the head.
And it's pretty cool. They've actually tested this design in weightlessness. There's a giant tower that they drop stuff in to test how things react in microgravity. And they, you know, actually filled up the glass with whiskey and dropped it in this tower to see. And it, you know, functioned as it should have. So, yeah, next step is to, you know, get some astronauts to pop some bottles and
Yeah, I saw this video and it was actually pretty cool. So we'll make sure to link, you know, a video to the website too, so that way folks can see it in action.
Another thing, back down on Earth, have you heard of Stonehenge?
Oh yeah, absolutely, dude. There's all kinds of theories and stuff like that based on Stonehenge and, you know, how, you know, people form these massive rock, you know, formations, or if people even formed them, if it wasn't, you know, something from outer space, another outward being or something of that nature. So yeah, there's a lot of superstition that goes on around Stonehenge.
Well, researchers have found a new Stonehenge. They're calling the Superhenge, which sounds like a weird, like, you know, European metal band. But it's about 2 miles from the original Stonehenge site, and it's, like, just massive. There's, like, saying there's probably close to 90 large stones that are, like as big as, if not bigger than, the Stonehenge stones. And they're estimating that this monument was built around 4,500 years ago.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, you know, just knowing the complexity and, you know, the just the sheer scale of this, I mean, it's freaking mind-boggling to try to think about how, you know, folks would have gone about, you know, building some of these things.
Yeah, the stones are said to be around 15 foot high, and the were arranged in a circular pattern that's almost a mile wide, making it the largest earthwork of its kind in Britain that have been, you know, discovered so far. So you don't know if it's part of the Stonehenge was part of this bigger thing or if this is something, you know, completely different. But yeah, they've Vince Gaffey of the University of Bradford has been studying the area, and like I said, they've found all kind of stuff, the, you know, this larger Stonehenge and possibly chapels and other, you know, whatchamacallit, sites for
just like big arenas, right? Or
The word I look for is
that's it.
Yeah, you know when you like do stuff for like a reason.
Yeah, intent.
No, like the actual event itself.
I don't know where you're going, man.
Fuck.
I think it's the Dayquil kicking in.
Yeah, never mind.
Yeah, screw that idea. On to a better one. But no, I was reading here that, you know, Gaffney told the Guardian that basically he thinks that this might be some kind of arena or something of that nature. So I don't know, man. I'm just really curious to see, you know, the greater
rituals. That's rituals. The fucking word I was trying to think of.
There it is.
Yeah. Sorry, folks. I'm recovering from Concred and I'm high on Dayquil.
That's no excuse, man. We're always high on something. Usually life.
Yeah, like sites for ceremonies and rituals is the words I was trying to contemplate earlier. But yeah, this is, I mean, no one really, I mean, hell, we still don't really know what Stonehenge was used for. So now that we found this bigger, massive thing, you know, who knows what was going on out there.
Dude, what if it's like an entire, like city or something like that that people didn't even realize, you know, up to this point that exist?
I'm not going to say aliens, but
it's probably aliens.
And speaking of aliens, Apple is hiring people to predict what you're thinking.
Like psychics? Not just psychics, but artificial intelligence psychics.
Yeah, they're hiring, they're wanting to improve your basically your smartphones and computers to predict what you're going to want them to do. So it will have your sports scores, whatever, before you even ask. They're hiring people that have, you know, PhDs and artificial intelligence experts trying to improve what they call machine learning. So your phone, as you use it more, learns your habits, knows you check Facebook 50 times a day. So as soon as you pick up your phone, it's already there. It's, yeah, they're basically building Skynet what's going
to
happen.
I'm about to say, like, I don't think I'm down with this technology because you know all of that is going to go into some kind of massive database used for marketing purposes. And, you know, hackers are having a field day with just all the digital information out there on the net as it is. And I don't care how secure you say, you know, things are, they are not that secure. You know, all you're doing is giving, you know, people an initiative to become smarter and figure out how to break your processes. Like, before long, we're going to be, you know, all hacked as individuals.
Yeah. One of the things that some of their competitors are saying is, you know, Apple's kind of going to be limited on what they can do with this because they have real strict privacy rules where people like, you know, Amazon, Facebook, Google, all this data that your phone collects, that all gets uploaded to a cloud and compared to other people's data to kind of improve the predicting algorithms. But since Apple doesn't like sharing any of that information, it will be kept, you know, maybe just within your device. So it's not going to be...
Yeah, but I say that's a crock, man. Yeah. I mean, the Apple TV came out and it's like, you know, that and the iPhone, like, oh, you turned off your iPhone. Well, the camera and the microphone and stuff like that didn't turn off. Your screen just went black. Like, no, you know, it's...
Yeah, but if that data is contained within, if not like within your ice, but in within Apple's network and not compared to like the world at large, you know, the it'd probably be more safer, but it's just not going
to. I don't know. I think that just gives hackers more initiative to figure out what's there and, you know, just start going after
accuracy
Apple.
Of their predictions.
Yeah, I don't know.
When my phone starts answering questions before I think of it. Yeah, it's good. Well, then again, half the time I pick up and like open up Google to look up something, and then I can't remember what I opened up Google to look up to begin with. So my phone can be, hey, dumbass, you were fixing to look up this. Then, you know, that might help me out, but then it also might, you know, help to enslave us to our eventual robot overlords.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just wondering, like, you go for a vaccine or something like that. Oh, you need this to fight off the super flu or whatever the next big virus or, you know, disease is, and, you know, instead they're injecting little, you know, microscopic robots that are transmitting data to, you know, the cloud and stuff. Like, maybe I'm overly paranoid, but at some point, man, like...
Fucking Skynet, yo.
I'm just going to take it old school. I'm going to build me a fort in the middle of the woods, no technology, no nothing, and strictly off the grid, because that's the only way to be safe.
But how are we going to upload the podcast?
We're going to use the trees, man.
We're going to have to drop our file in like a dead drop and have like an agent to upload it for us. All right, well, I think that about wraps up for science. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned, folks.
And now it's time for All Things Nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News, folks. We're both about dead. Why, you may ask? I think it has a little something to do with a little event called DragonCon.
DragonCon 2015.
Yeah, we survived the fire lashing of the dragon, but you know, we did suffer some bumps and bruises along the way.
Yeah, so I've been to DragonCon several times, but you know, this is the first time you've been in what, 10, 15 years, something like that.
A long time. Pretty much made me feel like a Dragon Con version, trying to, you know, walk around and get reacclimated where everything is. And it's just crazy how much it has expanded and grown and has become a, you know, popular thing. I've never seen that, you know, extensive collection of a like-minded group anywhere.
Yeah, no matter what your nerddom, you could find someone to
to
get along with down there. One of the things we did while we were down there was the Dragon Con Cigar Group's first official meetup, the Thursday night of Dragon Con we're at the Trader Vic's smoking deck. And I gotta say, you know, James did a good job of setting that stuff up, and it was way bigger event than we thought it was gonna be. We figured it's gonna be, you know, five or six of us hanging out smoking cigars, but I mean, it was probably, what, 50, 60 people there?
I'd say, you know, more than that. I mean, dude, when we walked out onto the patio, I mean, granted, there's no fans or anything to circulate the smoke and get it out in the streets. And it was just like, you know, stepping in, you know, a war zone of cigars.
My eyes were, like, immediately burning when we stepped outside. Yeah, I mean, there was raffles. They gave away a lot of stuff. We brought one of our cool Cigar Nerds coffee cups from our Zazzle store and raffled that off.
Was it that cool?
It was pretty cool.
I was actually surprised with the quality of it. Yeah. So.
And I haven't got around to posting any of the pictures yet because I've been like recovering and sleeping all week. But eventually I'll put that stuff up on our website. But yeah, and then also Podermo Cigars was there and they gave away a bunch of stuff. I actually won a Podermo Bugatti lighter. So I came out of there with something at least.
You can now say you got a Bugatti.
Yeah. Wish it was the other one.
I'll settle for a Bugatti lighter.
And the patches too. I can't remember the name of the artist who designed it.
Oh yeah, dude, the patches are freaking awesome.
He was there. He was one of the attending artists. He had a it's the name of his company, I think, is Urban Pop. Go look that up. They were in the artist alley, but he designed our Dragon Con patch, and that thing turned out really awesome.
Yeah, I couldn't believe the quality. I mean, you know, for this, just folks to come together, you know, and the whole thing came about, you know, like you said, originally with five or six folks just standing around, like, man, we should turn this into a unofficial, you know, Dragon Con event. And, dude, this thing excelled and took off.
Yeah, and even throughout the weekend, I noticed, kept watching the group on Facebook, and there were people like, hey, guys, I'm going to go smoke you know, out on this deck if anybody wants to join me. And, you know, even throughout the weekend, people were, you know, meeting up and having cigars throughout the whole event. So, yeah, it's definitely, you know, maybe it'll actually turn into an official event by next year.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if Trader Vic's is looking back on it saying, man, we really should have had some people waiting out on the patio area.
Yeah, I don't think they expected it to be as big as it was. So what's some highlights for you since, like I said, you haven't been in a while? Is there anything particular that stands out for you?
I mean, like I said, just the sheer, you know, magnitude of Dragon Con. I mean, it's been so long since I went that I couldn't take everything in this year. I mean, I pretty much spent the entire weekend just trying to get reacclimated as to where I was, where I was trying to go, and, you know, get distracted every time I turned a corner and... You know, it was chaos. You know, it's funny. We did the survival episode, and it's like, yeah, go with an itinerary. Itinerary went out the window. Like, there were...
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, was there any, like, costumes or anything like that you saw that was, like, particularly that stands out?
There's one, and it stood out to everybody. I got to give props to Strangeway and his Immortan Joe. That was freaking awesome.
Yeah. I mean, people were just bowing to him and, like, you know, witness
dude,
me.
That... You know, I mean, let's just put it in perspective. So, you know, Strangeway goes up to the loft overlooking the atrium of the Marriott with all the, you know, freaking, you know, Half-Life boys and everything else that was cosplaying.
Yeah.
You know, so they could be witnessed. I mean.
Yeah, there was every time I hung out with them, there was, like, so many random people, especially, like, Half-Life boys guys would, like, run up and, like, just get on their knees to him. I'm like, dude was... I talked to him later, and he's like, yeah, shit was, like, really hot. It was worse than wearing the FET, because it was all hard plastic and didn't breathe, but it was worth it to be, you know, King of Con.
So his costume really stood out. I saw some really, really awesome Deadpools, and it was awesome, too, you know, just getting to see the murder of Deadpools congregate, you yeah. know, and every time, you know, a Deadpool would pass a Deadpool, one of us, like...
that, and there was so many, like, mashup Deadpools, too, or what... That must have been the new thing this year, because it wasn't just Deadpools. There were so many, like, Deadpools cosplaying as other things. Like, I'm pretty sure I saw a Mary Poppins Deadpool at one point. I mean, it was, like, Deadpool in a full, like, Victorian dress with, like, an umbrella and shit, and, like, Dr. Deadpool. I think I saw a Karate Kid Deadpool at one point. I mean, there's just so many different versions of Deadpool running around. I think the one thing I saw that, like, really stood out was the guy who had the full Dragon Zord costume.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome. you know, the Mario cosplays were actually really cool, too.
There was a shitload of Marios this year for some reason. I don't know why. It's not like there's a new, you know, I don't know if there's like a new game or anything, but yeah, there was a lot of Marios. That, and I saw one guy that cracked me up because he was dressed as Constantine, and it was a perfect Constantine, but apparently everyone thought he was Castiel, so he's like walking around with a sign like, I'm not fucking Castiel from Supernatural.
Yes. That was awesome. I mean, some of the events we got to attend, you know, whether it was the raves or just, you know, running into different musicians as we were making our paces through the hotels and stuff like that, definitely got exposed to some new music that I thought was pretty cool. You know, and just, people say that nerds don't know how to party. Dude. I say those folks have never been to Dragon Con to see nerds party. Like, I mean, you know, volunteering and being on the security staff, definitely got to see some shit, you know, especially that 12 a.m. to 4 a.m.
Yeah, this probably wasn't my, like, favorite Dragon Con, but I got to say, all the things that happened was not Dragon Con's fault. Like we said, we had our room got screwed up, And then I felt like we were kind of just tired all weekend because, like, you know, the sleeping situation. So Dragon Con was Dragon Con. It was the other stuff that kind of screwed up my time. But as far as the stuff that we actually did get to see, I mean, it was excellent. One of the things, I can't remember his name. We just randomly, because we couldn't get into a panel we wanted, went to this Star Wars and Gaming panel, and it turned out to be the designer of the X-Wing miniatures game. And that was cool, like, meeting him. He signed a custom card for me, and you got to ask him, you know, a bunch of questions about the development of the game, which I thought was pretty awesome. Like I said, we definitely hit a few parties, and we also, you know, met up with our fellow ESO hosts and got to meet some of the other guys that we don't normally get to meet face-to-face.
That was a good time. I don't know how much of that I remember. I mean, but I can say that, you know, you show up with 3 gallons of pie to record a podcast. I see you're doing it right.
Yeah, the podcast. That's I don't know how much that's going to be usable audio. A few things that stood out to me for me especially that, and I apologize because I didn't get this lady's name because, like I said, I was exhausted and I think I was on my way to something else. But this was like, you know, gave me a boost for the night. Was I was wearing one of my Cigar Nerds t-shirts, and this lady stopped me outside the Hyatt and was like, "Oh my God, are you on the Cigar Nerds podcast?" I'm like, "Yeah." She's like, "Oh my God, I love you guys. I've listened to like every episode." So, you know, if you're listening to this, thank you very much. You know, like I said, we don't get do a lot of live stuff, so we don't normally run into the people that are actually listening to this. So it was like really awesome to like run into someone who actually knew who the hell we were.
Yeah, I mean, we get that, you know, a little bit at cigar events and things of that nature, but, you know, to especially as vast as Dragon Con is, you know, it's awesome to have that recognition, and, you know, we appreciate it when folks walk up and, you know, give us, you know, praises and...
Yeah, it's nice to know that, like, what we're doing is actually, you know, affecting people and stuff. And another thing, I got a call, I believe it was Saturday, from George from Real Men Smoke Cigars, to say someone actually ordered one of our cigar smoking shirts. So I want to give a shout out to Randall Lockie, if I'm pronouncing this right, as being our first you know, shirt customer. So, woohoo!
Yep, that was awesome. Yeah, we were walking around the dealer room, and you're like, "Dude!" And I'm like, "Dude, sweet!" Yeah, it was pretty cool.
So with that, you got any other Dragon Con final thoughts, or on to the next news?
Dragon Con final thoughts. Do it right, folks. Make the great land grab. Don't try to, you know, yeah, it's just the hotels, you know. I mean, they do the best they can, but, you know, 6 guys in a single bedroom.
Yeah, we were supposed to have a double room and have a bed space, and then they screwed up, and we ended up getting, like, a really small king room for 6 dudes, and we had to sleep on the floor because we were expecting a bed and didn't bring any kind of air mattresses or stuff, and that just kind of... like screwed up the whole weekend because we were not sleeping at all that weekend because we were kind of like sleeping in shifts.
And then, you know, being on the 41st floor of the Marriott, that put high. Things in perspective. Like when your ears pop from the pressure differences, you know you're doing it right.
Yeah, you just spend the whole weekend not looking over the edge of the balcony because you're like, whoa.
Well, I mean, even when you did, like, it was, you know, awesome. I mean,
like, the people didn't even look like people that high up.
I mean, they literally look like ants. But it was kind of cool, you know, being out to look over the city of Atlanta and seeing the Varsity and all of, you know, these little hangouts and things of that nature. So there were definitely some good things. I had a blast. It was definitely a learning experience for me, and I look forward to doing it again next year.
Definitely, definitely. So another thing that kind of happened while we were away was Force Friday. They've unleashed all the new Force Unleashed toys and stuff was all kind of released. So there's a whole bunch of new toys, games, and whatnot that have come out. Like we didn't, like I said, we were at Dragon Con during this, so we did not get a chance to actually go out and do any shopping ourselves. But there's a lot of cool new stuff that has hit the market.
I'm just looking here at the Chewbacca Nerf bowcaster. This thing looks pretty sweet. Like, I'd love to steampunk this out.
That, and there was some talking action figures too. So it's like the first time we've actually been able to hear any of the characters speak.
Oh yeah, dude, and these things are like 14 and a half inches too. Like, this is a very sizable you know, action figure.
And a few of the things that, like, from that there's actually a few like new details that you get from just listening to the for one the stormtrooper, the black stormtrooper guy in the commercials, who everyone's been calling Finn. one of the dolls like refers to like FN8, some, you know, gives like a trooper number. So Finn might not even be his actual name, and this may be a shortening of his like trooper number. And there was another one, the Kylo Ren doll says something like, you know, I'm here to like, you know, destroy the last Jedi or something, which if he's referring to Luke as being the last Jedi, I'm like, that's going to kind of disappoint me as a, on just like a storytelling level, because it's been like 30 years. Like, in the expanded universe, Luke has rebuilt the entire Jedi Order by now. If he hasn't been sitting around for the last 30 years with his, like, robotic thumb up his ass doing nothing, I'm going to be real disappointed if he's the only freaking Jedi in this movie.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, that's the thing. It's, we're starting to learn more about characters. We've seen how great, you know, the film itself looks, but we still don't know shit about the story.
I know.
Which, I mean, in a way, I guess it's pretty good. I mean, you know, we're going to go into it not knowing what we're going to get ourselves into. But, you know, still, like, I can't believe, as, you know, big as Star Wars is, how good of a job they've done at keeping everything tight-lipped. I mean,
oh, yeah, one thing I saw, they also released a Force Awakens version of the X-Wing game, like a new core set that has like the new version of the X-Wing and some of the new TIE fighters in it, and some like,
oh, that'll be sweet,
new pilot cards and stuff. So that was kind of cool seeing those ships finally. And like, so they've released a lot of like diecast models and new Lego sets of the new,
yeah,
the new
Millennium Falcon from Force Awakens, the Lego set. That thing looks awesome.
Yes, it actually has an old man Han Solo a minifig in it too, and that's really the only place you can get that is that version of the Millennium Falcon. And there's also been a lot of like cool science games that have been released too. There's like one where you can actually, it's kind of like the old 20 questions game, but it's Star Wars based, where it's, you know, you can think of something in the Star Wars universe and it will guess it within 20 questions of what you're actually thinking. There's another one where it's like a hologram board and you can actually move stuff around just by your thoughts. So you can actually, like,
sweet,
you know, try to use the Force, and it somehow predicts like what you're thinking and makes you, you know, kind of like the old holo chessboard. You can move stuff around using your thoughts. I saw there's another one where you can actually use, like, it looks like some kind of like electrostatic thing where there's like a ball that you can like move using the Force, however that works. I don't know.
That's interesting.
Another thing, because I've been wanting a drone, and they've just released a Millennium Falcon and X-Wing remote-controlled drone you can get now, too. So that's something I may want to hunt down.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, Adidas has now teamed up with Star Wars to bring, you know, customizable Star Wars sneakers and stuff of that nature. So I was inside, you know, a Kohl's earlier today, and you know, I was like, man, I need some, you know, business casual clothing. And, dude, the amount of Star Wars stuff was insane that they had. Like, that's not a store that I would typically expect to walk into and find, you know, all kinds of Star Wars apparel. Just moving on into some other quick news tidbits. We found out that Olivia Cooke is going to be cast in Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One. Folks may know her from Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, Bates Motel, and
it has been announced, but I'm pretty sure she's going to be playing Artemis.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at. You know, next,
which I did see a guy dressed as Percival at Dragon Con.
I thought that was cool.
Because it was one of those random things that only a few people got, because he was dressed in normal clothes, but he had this sign above his head that would look like, you know, if you were in a VR world, your player icon, and it said Percival, and I'm like, oh shit, Ready Player One. He's like, haha, you get it. You're one of us.
Yes, that's awesome. Legendary Pictures has plans for a new Godzilla vs. King Kong movie. Yeah, I was a big fan of the original.
Go, go, Godzilla.
Yeah, I don't even know how old that movie is now, but you know, I'd love to see it with the updated graphics and everything else, so it looks like we're going to get the... they're going to reboot from Universal to Warner Brothers. So, you know, hopefully they do a good job of the film. But I'm excited about it, being a monster movie fan.
Hells yes.
Anything additional, Joe, that you know about or want to... final thoughts?
No, I don't have any final thoughts anymore.
Dayquil and some more pie and...
oh, pie.
Yes.
Well, with that, you know, check out the show at CigarNerdPodcast.com. Check us out on the ESO Network, ESOPodcast.com. Check us out on Twitter and Instagram at CigarNerdPod. You can email us at CigarNerdPodcast.com. Also, check out our Zazzle store at zazzle.com/cigarnerdpodcast, or buy a shirt at realmensmokecigars/cigarnerds. And with that, what's your favorite scary movie?
And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We are your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.